Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts, coming to you this week from the Portland Book Festival. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and today I'm joined by a New York Times best-selling author and cartoonist. Her work has appeared in The Village Voice, The National Lampoon, Scientific American, Mother Jones, and most notably, The New Yorker. The New Yorker's David Remnick said of her, "She's got a very recognizable style of squiggly lines and neurotic characters." Roz Chast, it's a pleasure to have you on Words and Pictures.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So about that David Remnick quote, is that pretty accurate? You do like to draw neurotic people, but also inanimate objects, lamps and wallpaper and knickknacks.
I guess I don't really see them necessarily as neurotic. They're just kind of responding to life in what seems like a very normal way.
I'd like to talk about your most recent book. Here's a testimonial from Alison Bechdel, author of Fun Home. "I must be dreaming" is Roz Chast at her chastiest, serving up cartoons direct from the source of her apparently vintage chintz upholstered unconscious. And you put it all in a nutshell in one of your Instagram posts where you wrote, "Dreams are weird and not my fault."
Yeah, that's, dreams are weird and they're not my fault. And they really do come from some place that I don't fully understand. And I've always, since I was a child, found them to be mysterious, but engaging and just deeply interesting.
And here's a quote from the book. "What I love most about dreams is how every night, without conscious effort on my part, these off-the-wall movies unspool, and I have no idea why or how."
Yeah. Yes, there are everyday dreams, there's celebrity dreams, there's dentist dreams, there's body horror. It's just like you wake up and suddenly you have like 8 fingers or 18 fingers on each hand, and just all kinds of strange stuff. So yeah, there's different categories, and then there's the ones that I think of as just everyday dreams that are odd and sometimes funny.
And then there are the lucid dreams, which are interesting because they cross over that veil.
Yes. Lucid dreams, that's a very good way to put it. They do sort of cross a certain strange veil where, am I dreaming or am I awake? But I had a lucid dream where I was on the subway and my husband called me and he said, "You sound weird." And I said, "Yes, of course I sound weird. I'm dreaming." So, I don't know, that I had to write up.
And the fun part is, I mean, you've done some research on this. You've really done your background. You go into the Kabbalah, you go into Freud, you go into Jung, you go into the Egyptians and the Greeks, the philosophers.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem that as far back as, you know, people started being conscious of themselves and conscious of their thoughts, that people have always been curious about the dream state, what it was, and whether it had meaning or whether it didn't have meaning, and if it had meaning, then what was the meaning? And, you know, a lot of ancient cultures believed that they were predictive and that you could take the elements of your dreams and you would be able to tell what was going to happen in the future. And, you know, I know there were, you know, generals that had special people who sort of dreamed for him or that would interpret his dreams and, you know, tell them like how a battle was going to play out and things like that. Or people who felt that they maybe weren't predictive, but this is way, way before like Freud, but that they could, they had a key to maybe helping them live a better life, or like problems that, you know, they were having, and the dream might give you a key to solve those problems.
And you point out the rivalry between Freud and Jung, and it had a big bearing on dreams. Freud thought that dreams were just for the person, from the person.
Yes.
Jung thought there was something a lot deeper.
Yes. Well, Jung very much believed in the collective unconscious, and he believed in archetypes that crossed over cultures, and that in some profound level, in some profound way, we were all connected in this, you know, collective unconscious, and that dreams gave access to that.
And there's the creativity aspect too. I mean,
yeah, there's lots of reasons that people have come up with for dreaming and creative problem solving. And I think that probably all of these reasons are true to some extent, but I don't think that anybody really knows the full, you know, reason why we dream.
You quote the Japanese writer Haruki Murakami, who said, "For me, writing a novel is like having a dream. Writing a novel lets me intentionally dream while I'm awake."
Yes, yes, I really responded to that quote, which is why I included it, because I think for what I do, you know, thinking up cartoons, most of my life is spent sort of thinking. It's not the same as dreaming, but it's definitely letting your thoughts kind of go where they may, and to make associations, and to think of things that, you know, that usually if you live a life where you don't have any sort of quiet time, where it's just you're constantly bombarded by stuff, I think it's, you know, I remember this from when I had small children, you don't really have that kind of space to let your thoughts kind of flow, and then look at those thoughts and think about those thoughts and make associations. And, you know, for me as a cartoonist, I'm looking for, you know, where the funny is. And that's how I work. But yeah, I did definitely respond to that quote because I thought that's what we do, you know, people who write or paint, or, you know, you're looking at what you're thinking in a certain way.
The Dadaists and the Surrealists, they believed in the unconscious and they believed in dreams for inspiration.
Yeah, yes, yes, this is true. Right, right. Dreams have always been a part, I think, of creating stuff, you know, because dreams are so creative. They just are. And with like no effort. I mean, that's the best part. You're just kind of like, you know, and, you know, the craziest kind of things just pop up. And sometimes they're completely stupid and sometimes they're hilarious. And I don't know. I enjoy it. I mean, I have a couple of like longer dreams in the book, but generally they're not more than like a page or something like that.
Yeah, I love the cartoon ideas aspect of the book because they're so half-formed, but in the dream, you're sure these are the most amazing ideas ever.
Completely, completely. I mean, I still remember, you know, waking up laughing from some of these completely useless cartoon dreams, although occasionally one does sort of become a cartoon. I mean, I included a couple of these ridiculous ones in the book as examples. I had one where, and again, this is Harry Wilmer, whose work I love. He's a writer and a psychiatrist and a Jungian psychiatrist. He knows everything about Jung and his beliefs. Harry Wilmer said that the dreaming brain loves jokes, loves puns, loves all this kind of stuff. And I certainly have had those kinds of ideas in my dream. I mean, I remember having a dream about, remember that TV show Ted Lasso? I had a dream about a character named Tad Less So. So he was, you know, this kind of schlubby, even schlubbier than Ted Lasso. He was a tad less so. But that's what dreaming brains do. Oh, the terrible dream was, it was about swans square dancing. And I dreamed of a cartoon where I would have, it's called Swan Dancing. And it was really like four pairs of swans square dancing. And in the dream, I just thought this was incredibly funny. It woke me up laughing. And then I just thought, this is really not funny. This is like stupid. But that's, you know, that's dreams.
Well, you know, that's the value in the dumb stuff. Like Jung would talk about the scarab beetle. Like, you know, here's this character that's revered, but he's rolling around dung, you know. So, I mean, there's wonderful regenerative properties in the dung.
Yeah. It just the things that you associate that you might block out, you know, in your conscious life, you know.
As an artist, I'm sure you've had people ask you, where do you get your ideas? I've been certainly asked the same thing. My response is that ideas are coming to all of us all the time. Most of them are pretty silly, but artists don't self-censor as much as other people do. We might spend some time with a silly idea until it becomes something more polished.
Yes, that's true, because sometimes you just have a sense that there's something there, but you just have to dig a little deeper and, you know, maybe polish it, maybe just find it. So, you know, you just have a sense that there's something there, which sometimes, you know, you don't find it, but sometimes you do, you know.
Well, you called the blank sheet of paper the blazing island of white.
Yes, well, that I took from Bill Woodman, a cartoonist from a few decades ago. That's what he called the blank piece of paper, the blazing island of white, and I just think that's a pretty accurate description.
More than a century ago, some of the most popular newspaper comics had dream logic as their theme. There were two by Winsor McCay, Dream of the Rarebit Fiend and Little Nemo in Slumberland.
Little Nemo, I do know. Yeah, that was great. And the way the legs of the bed would like get like really long and then just start walking. And yeah, to me, it's interesting material, you know.
Well, you may not have come up with your best comic ideas while dreaming, but there's a famous story about the 19th century chemist Friedrich August Kekulé. You know, up to that point in the mid-19th century, people had been struggling to figure out the molecular structure of benzene.
Oh, yeah, right. And he's the one with the snake swallowing.
Yeah, so yeah. Kekulé, he goes to sleep. He dreams of an Ouroboros, the snake biting his own tail. And when he woke up, he drew up the model of the benzene ring. It was a scientific breakthrough.
That is, yeah, there, and I'm sure there have been others. I mean, I did write about this a little bit in the book, that I think that our brains are working on stuff all the time, you know, while we're sleeping. And, you know, sometimes I'm amazed, but I like to do crossword puzzles. And a lot of times I'll just hit a wall, you know, with a crossword puzzle, and then I have to step away from it. And then I come back to it, and it's like I can kind of see where I went wrong. But it took sort of stepping away from it. And I always wonder what, you know, was my brain working on this in some weird part, some like back room? Was it like, you know, doing like a little Rubik's Cube with stuff? I don't fully know. But I think that's partly why dreams are interesting, because they're a part of the brain that we don't fully understand, you know? And yet it's very creative, I think.
So we've all got a little obsessive child in the back of our head.
Oh, for sure. You know, I hope so. Maybe Jeff Bezos doesn't. I don't know. You know.
Let's talk about another graphic memoir that affected people deeply. This was the number one New York Times bestseller for, 2 years running? It was about your experiences with your parents toward the end of their lives. And it's called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? It won the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Rubin Award from the National Cartoonist Society, and the inaugural Kirkus Nonfiction Prize. It was a finalist for the National Book Award. It was obviously a painful story for you, but there was so much entertainment in it. There was so much leavening value throughout the book.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that you liked it.
Did you find the writing of those experiences, those rough experiences of seeing your parents through caregiving, losing one of them and then the other, you know, how was the process of putting that together into a book? Was it jarring? Was it enlightening? Was it, did it help, you know, put everything into a helpful narrative?
I think my instinct with work is that for me, putting things into a narrative is maybe for me the way I try to make sense of everything, you know, not just that experience, but everything. Because I do find life is kind of stressful. Yeah, and most of the time I find it just like I don't want to deal with it. It's just very difficult. And somehow drawing about things and writing about things and making a narrative out of things, I don't know if it helps me understand, but it feels necessary. Otherwise, it's just, you know, I feel like I'm just floating in space and asteroids are just hitting me like left and right and I don't know what to do. So this is a way for me to deal with it.
Well, your parents grew up during the Depression and that affected them deeply and it also affected you deeply. And, you know, some of those traits just exhibited themselves more and more towards the end of their life.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I do think there were many, many things in their lives that were so hard. You know, they weren't children in the Depression. They graduated from college into the Depression. They were both born in 1912. So for so many reasons, they just had very hard lives. They were both children of immigrants who didn't speak a lot of English, didn't speak any English for the most part. They both grew up very, very poor in New York. They went to city colleges, and then they wanted to be teachers, and they made very little money. And then, you know, the Depression made things even worse. And they had a child before me, a baby that died. You know, I think that was extremely traumatic for them, which is why they waited. You know, 12 or 13 years later, I was born. They were in their 40s already. I just had gone through a lot, you know. My mother lost an uncle in Treblinka. You know, they were firsthand for all the horrors of World War II. My father was in World War II. He was in the Navy. He was a censor, actually. And they just had lives that were very, very hard. You know, harder than my life. And I think they were very afraid. They were very afraid that something bad would happen to me. And, you know, I think that affected me more than probably I knew, definitely more than I knew at the time, and probably more than I know now. It's like things are okay right now, but any minute, like something unbelievably horrible can happen, and it probably will. So, yeah.
That may have informed some of your nightmares.
Yeah, my nightmares. I mean, most people I know who are in comedy, they're not like the most jolly, well-adjusted people. Let's put it that way.
Have you had people tell you that this book, Can't We Talk About Something Pleasant, that they were navigating the same situation and these strange situations that you wrote down in the book, that this was helpful somehow?
Yeah, I've had all sorts of people tell me that. I mean, not just like Jewish people from New York, but like people from like all very different backgrounds from mine, people whose parents were from, you know, like a farm in Iowa or whatever, like something very, very different from my parents, but amazingly similar trajectories and emotional experiences.
I remember one particular story, and this is about your mother fading away in hospice, mostly unconscious and sleeping. And then one day you show up and she's sitting up with the nurse eating a tuna fish sandwich.
Yeah.
And you wonder to yourself, what stage of this process is the tuna fish sandwich stage?
Yeah, part of going through that for me was just how completely ignorant I was of that part of life. I mean, it was just never talked about. When I looked for information about it, there was just like nothing. Or I would read, like, there was always some sort of like bullshit, a deathbed reconciliation. And every movie, every book, it would be like on the person's deathbed, suddenly there would be this thing and then it would be great. And I think I was sort of hoping or expecting that, you know, foolishly. And a lot of people it doesn't happen for, you know. And then that's just life, you know? That's just the way it is. And it's just one of those things that there's so much in the popular culture about that, you know, that for me was maybe the hardest thing of all. And just then also just the laughable, you know, aspect of just how fucking expensive the last few years. And my parents were such incredible, like, scrimpers and savers and, like, you know, shopping over here because something was 15 cents less over here. And then these assisted living places, they know they've got you over a barrel and they're going to just take everything. And they do. It, you know, you just kind of throw up your hand and say, well, you know, this is what it is. This is what our culture kind of is also. You know, I mean, it just seems like a very lazy thing to say, ah, it's our culture. But, you know, because, yes, I could have taken my parents into my house and taken care of them. But my husband certainly didn't want that. And I wasn't a nurse. And I had two children at home also. And, you know, we don't live with these big extended families anymore where people can take turns or there's shifts. And I'm an only child. I didn't have, like, you know, brothers and sisters or cousins or whatever in the neighborhood where we could all pitch in and do something. So, you know, it was really just doing the best I could. And sometimes it wasn't very good.
You're listening to Words and Pictures, coming to you this week from the Portland Book Festival. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today we're talking with award-winning author and cartoonist Roz Chast. She's seen over 1,000 of her cartoons published in The New Yorker, and she's the author of multiple books, including the graphic memoirs Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And I Must Be Dreaming.
But you did have dreams of your parents after they died.
Yes.
And what was that like? I mean, what was the difference between your waking experiences of your folks and how they appeared to you later?
It makes a certain sense to me. I felt like when my father died that it was okay, that things were, you know, they weren't perfect. I wish I had been nicer in many ways, but he would appear in my dreams sometimes, and he was usually all right. With my mother, it was different. She was suffering in ways. Mm. And I still sometimes have dreams about her where, you know, she's collapsed in some way and I have to take care of her. And so I know that's just my karma or whatever word you want to use, my, you know, where things were not quite right with my mother and things were better with my father. But, you know, so that's reflected in my dream life. I mean, big shockaroo, you know.
Now, you're a New Yorker through and through. And so are both of your parents.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the space where you're comfortable, you know all the ins and outs.
I know enough of them so that I'm less uncomfortable there than I am any other place. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that I really do not like to drive. I don't like cars. I don't like anything about them. I don't, the idea of changing, you know, a tire is scary. The idea of calling AAA to have them change a tire is scary. Everything about it is being on a highway and having everything about driving I hate. I just do not like it at all. And when I'm in New York, it's just this whole phobia aspect that I can just push aside. You know, like, I am like anybody else in the city. I, like a grown-up person, I can get myself around. I'm not dependent on other people. I don't have to think about, like, oh, if I drive there, I'm going to be driving back at night. Or, oh, driving there, it involves a highway. And I have a GPS, which has helped, but it doesn't matter. Because then I worry, what happens if the GPS goes off? And that once happened, it like did something. It like, I don't know whether it like went off or it had to reboot or something. And it was like the whole time I was driving, it was just like this nightmare. You know, driving is a lot of it. But it's also, you know, it's home. It's where I grew up. So it's familiar in a certain way.
Well, you do divide your time between New York and Connecticut.
Yes.
And your youngest daughter decided to move to Manhattan to attend the School of Visual Arts.
Yes.
And you started writing a guidebook for her.
Yes.
That ended up becoming the graphic memoir, Going Into Town, A Love Letter to New York. And along the way, it just happened to win the New York City Book Award.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, you know, when she, and I should say here, she was she then, she's trans, he's my son now. But back then, she was my daughter. So anyway, before she went off to School of Visual Arts, we were up in Connecticut, and I thought, okay, I should explain some, like, basics to her about New York. You know, the things that they don't mention in the guidebooks, like the grid aspect of Manhattan and the way that Fifth Avenue divides the East Side from the West Side, basic stuff. So I was explaining, I still remember, we were sitting at the kitchen counter, and I was like, okay, so if you want to walk, if you're the grid makes navigation very easy. You're on 53rd Street, you want to walk to 56th Street, you walk three blocks uptown. And she looked at me and she said, what's a block? And I realized that we needed to go a little deeper into, you know, this kind of thing. So that book was based on a little booklet that I had made for her. And at the end of 4 years of college, she gave it back to me and said, you know, this was extremely helpful. Thank you. And, you know, it had little maps in it. It was like how to hail a cab, what the major cross streets were, the locations of the best museums, why you needed to know what the major cross streets were, because, you know, with the subway line, there's the East Side lines, the West Side lines, the difference between them, that kind of stuff, just basic stuff, how to get a Metro card, all of that. And I thought, you know, this would be a fun book, because I really do love New York, like, deeply. So that's where that book came from.
Well, and some of the cultural quirks of New York are fading away. The little strange pockets, the little things only the natives and the insiders know. Yeah. But some of that stuff is still there and has made its way into the book.
Yes, they're definitely, it's still there. It's still there, not as much. I mean, the pandemic wiped out some of it, and just everything. New York is always changing. I still remember being a young cartoonist and being with some older cartoonist, maybe like 30 years older than me, and, you know, him talking, oh, New York's not the same, you know, 30 years ago is blah. And so I'm very wary of, like, that kind of nostalgia for the way things used to be.
Well, you said the pandemic changed a lot, but New York is still an important place to be in the arts.
Oh, completely.
And to be even a cartoonist. I mean, you still get together with your other cartoonist friends.
Not the way it was. I mean, it used to be people would go in person and meet with the art editor, the cartoon editor at the New Yorker, and that is no longer.
And that would be on a particular day, so you'd have conversations together.
Right, of course. And we would, you know, compare notes, and it was a very congenial, very bonding sort of thing. You know, I did that mostly through the 80s, and then when I had my children and we moved out to Connecticut, I had to send stuff in. I faxed in for a long time. Now I make a PDF and send in. But people were still, up until a few years ago, up until before the pandemic, people were getting together for lunch, some of the younger cartoonists. But, you know, I had done that. It was wonderful. It was great.
Well, I first encountered your cartoons in the National Lampoon.
Oh, my God.
When I was a teenager. The comics pages were always my favorite part of the magazine.
Me too. The funny pages.
And even in that rough and tumble magazine, your cartoons were always sweet. Sweet, but with an edge, no matter where your work appears.
Thank you. Yeah, maybe.
It seems like the other cartoonists in the funny pages, that there was some sort of a give and take. There was some sort of a little community there.
Yeah. I think for me, because, I mean, I loved so many of the cartoonists at the National Lampoon, but I sort of connected with the New Yorker so early that that became my world, you know, more so than the National Lampoon. So the cartoonists that I got to know were the New Yorker cartoonists, and those were the people I hung out with.
And there was some crossover.
Yeah, there was some crossover. But, you know, it was still our group. And but, yeah, definitely like Sam Gross and all those people.
And you've had some interesting collaborations, including with Steve Martin.
Yeah.
The alphabet from A to Y with bonus letter Z.
Yes. Yes. I like collaborations. Steve Martin, Stephen Merritt from Magnetic Fields, we did a book. Calvin Trillin, my dear friend Patricia Patty Marks. We've collaborated on several books, children's books and also humor books.
Yeah, there's a couple. Why don't you write my eulogy now so I can correct it, A Mother's Suggestions, and You Can Only Yell at Me for One Thing at a Time, Rules for Couples.
Yes, yes, and this is Patty. The eulogy book was things that Patty's mother, who was a hoot, used to say. Things like, never serve salmon at a dinner party, it is boring, and plaids should never be based in white. She had like a lot of really wonderful rules. But she did say to Patty once, why don't you write your eulogy for me now so I could correct it? And the other one, the rules for couples, that's what her boyfriend said to her. You can only yell at me for one thing at a time. But there's all kinds of things in there, like marriage is one person secretly turning up the thermostat and the other person secretly turning down the thermostat until one of you dies. And she's just hilarious. So she did the writing and I did the drawing. But collaborating with Patty is really special because it's more of a Venn diagram. There's always an area in the middle where, you know, she can suggest the drawings and I can suggest ideas.
Yeah, one of the things you teamed up with New Yorker writer Patty Marks was you did some ukulele performances
together. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. We've... That was the most nuts thing. She was invited to a wedding, and everybody had to bring an instrument to serenade the bride and groom. And Patty doesn't play any instrument. In fact, she's tone deaf. But she thought, okay, the ukulele, how hard can that be? So she went on Amazon. She bought like this turquoise ukulele. And she said, Roz, this is like the most fun you're ever going to have for $50. So I bought a turquoise ukulele. And she's very good at like making up funny lyrics to like popular domain songs, which are our specialty. And I'm like not bad at like choosing the chords. So we started like just, I think we did it just for like some friends. We would like play a few songs. And then we got into this thing where we made up, just to make each other laugh, like this completely phony baloney sort of like origin story of our group, which we called Ukular Meltdown, and about how we had both grown up in Russia. I don't know. It was like some like nuts origin story. And it just got funnier and more like absurd. And then somehow it started to become like other people started asking us to play at some dinner party that they were giving or like a fundraising thing. And then it was like a friend, actually Isaac Mizrahi, he sings at, you know, the fashion designer, he sings at the Cafe Carlyle and he's really incredible. It was like, would you like to, you know, have a guest spot at the Cafe Carlyle? So suddenly we're like at the Cafe Carlyle with our like ukuleles and playing. Just, it was very short, you know, luckily that's, you know, our strong suit is that the songs are short. So like nobody has to suffer for too long. But this just kind of came sort of very, again, a very dreamy sort of thing, you know, because you're thinking about this turquoise ukulele and then just making up this completely fictitious first album, you know, because the group is Ukular Meltdown, so Duck and Cover was our big hit. It's like, we never had a record, you know. Oh, and then I love Photoshop, like fooling around in Photoshop. So, like, I had made up all these pictures of us on Ed Sullivan, and we're with the Beatles, and Joan Baez, and, oh, you know, we went to the moon. So we would, you know, do these, like, slideshows showing, like, our we were at Woodstock. Nonsense, just complete. And Patty is incredibly funny. She's just really, really, really funny. But together, you know, it works.
You know, it sounds like what the surrealists and the Dada artists were going for was to push aside the conscious mind That's what you were doing.
Yeah, we were just fooling around, really. It's not serious. I mean, as I said, the ukulele is really halfway, unless you get like really good at it, it's halfway between an instrument and a toy. And if you know, you can learn it in an afternoon. You just go on YouTube and watch a few tutorials. It's just a lot of fun.
So you've been with The New Yorker since 1978. You've done over 1,000 cartoons. You've done cover designs. Do you have any projects that you've wanted to do for a while that you just haven't gotten to yet?
Well, I mean, my next thing that I really want to learn is block printing. So I don't know if that counts as like a project. It's like there's crafts I want to learn.
So you like the analog arts?
The analog art. Yeah, I like the digital ones. I mean, I have an iPad and I love to draw on it. It's fun. But yeah, there's something about analog art that I like, I guess, being unconnected to anything. There is something that's different. I haven't completely quantified it, what it is different about drawing digitally and drawing with physical materials. And I've talked about this with other artists and, you know, even like younger ones. And there's something when I see art that's like digital art, sometimes like I'll admire the drawing and all of that, but there's something that's distinctly different about it. And I see it in my own digital drawings. I think it's something about the consistency of the line. Like the pen always has some little glitches. You know, there's always unexpected stuff that happens. And it's just never perfect. And there's some kind of perfection in digital art that just can't exist with the physical materials. Like sometimes I'll just see like the way color is applied digitally. And it's much neater. You know, it's definitely within the lines. It's more even. And even when they do like shading and stuff, the shading is very good. It's much better in some ways. But there's something about it. I don't know. It's almost like auto-tune, you know, with singing, where you're making the voice sound better, but it also flattens out something, the human sound. And maybe that's what people want, you know, because the human sound is very embarrassing in a certain way. It's like human drawing is like you're going to go outside the lines and your pen is going to fuck up and, you know, you're going to put too much water on the brush or not enough and your hand's going to smear. I mean, I'm a lefty, so that's a problem for me. And your hand is tired, so you're going to cut a corner and you're going to make mistakes, and then you have to fucking patch it, and that looks like crap. And then it's just this, you know, the humanness of it is just very annoying and gross and bad. And when you do the digital thing, you just make it so much better. On the other hand, sometimes I feel that it flattens it out. And I can see it in my line, that the line. And I love my iPad. I love drawing with the Apple Pencil. It's pressure sensitive. I mean, the first time I tried, I thought, this is not like the Wacom tablet or like those old iterations of drawing digitally, which I hated. The minute I did the Apple Pencil, it was like, oh, this is a game changer. This is a whole different thing. But still, I see the line and also there's no original. You know, there's no physical thing. So you don't see the piece of paper that now has the warp in it and where the smear and where you made the mistake and where the whiteout is. And it's different.
Well, I remember reading what some Japanese or Arabic artists would say about mistakes in their work, and they would think of their drawing tools as their partners in the creative process. Like, okay, there's a hiccup in this line here, let's turn it into a boulder or a pine tree.
Yeah, yes, yes. And didn't the rug weaver sometimes like deliberately weave in a mistake because mm-hmm. otherwise it would be like an affront to God because only God is perfect. So I always thought that was sort of interesting. Of course, I don't have to deliberately make any mistakes because my work has so many just without my, you know, having to deliberately put them in. But yeah.
I'm remembering when Charles Schulz died and there were all these tributes to Sparky from his fellow cartoonists. And a couple of them said that they loved that he never got an inker to assist for him. He always did his own inks. And as his fingers started fluttering, sort of Parkinsonian flutter, it would change the line. And they loved the delicate way that that his ink line was in his later cartoons.
Wow, that's really interesting. Well, I don't think I'll ever have anybody do my work for me. It's, you know, something I need to do. I don't want to speak too soon. I just can't imagine, like, having somebody else do it, and they would do it wrong, and then I'd be sad, and then I'd have to, like, actually tell them, and that would be horrible.
Well, your youngest is out of SVA now, out of school.
Oh, yeah, my kids are grown-ups. I have an older son who's 36 and a younger one who's 32.
And any following in the footsteps of mom?
Well, the younger one who went to SVA, he started out as a cartooning major and then wound up in visual and critical studies, but is now a therapist, but still does wonderful art. Still does it for fun, for, you know, his own pleasure, but not professionally.
I love the crossover between cartooning and counseling.
Yes, yes, definitely, definitely. It's interesting. So we talk about, in fact, he was the one who put me on to Harry Wilmer, the Jungian analyst, who I just love the stuff that he writes about Jung and about therapy and about dreams and all of that.
And about the well of ideas.
Yeah, yeah, he's great. Harry Wilmer.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And my guest today has been New York Times bestselling author and cartoonist Roz Chast. She's the author of multiple books, including the graphic memoirs Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And I Must Be Dreaming. And her cartoons have appeared in The Village Voice, The National Lampoon, and of course, The New Yorker. Roz, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
Instagram, probably. Just Roz Chast.
And that's R-O-Z-C-H-A-S-T. Well, we've been coming to you today from the Portland Book Festival. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. And thanks to Literary Arts and to Mind the Bird Media for their collaboration. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.